Day, Williamson.
4th, June 74. Yeah, so that apparently was the trouble, that Minkowski couldn't believe that the supernova could be expanding that much and therefore had that much more energy if you put it at the 21 centimeter distance.
I think so. I think that's correct, yes. And we had difficulty too, we couldn't refuse his argument, and yet we had the observation. Maybe it's proper motions.
And you knew what the velocities of the arms were from the Dutch galactic structure study, I suppose.
Pretty well, I think, yes. Yes.
Let me ask about these observations vis-a-vis the NRL ones. Were they entirely independent, or did you know at NRL that they had detected it, or what was the story there?
No, we had very definitely made the observations at the time that Henry Brown made a visit to NRL and brought back with him, I don't know what the occasion was now, brought back with him essentially preprints of the NRL results. And we were absolutely flabbergasted, you see, that, here these guys got it.
Right.
Far superior to anything that we were able to observe at that time. We didn't, the big thing that we did not have was the narrow bandwidth.
Right.
We just couldn't produce, everything was predicated on wider bands, I forgot what they were, I suppose 30 or 50 kilohertz.
Yeah,
thing.
Something like that.
Yes.
And they had 10 kilohertz or...
And they had a switch on their receiver that you could switch it down, you see, and take it down. So, essentially now to redesign our equipment to make it do that, you see.
Right,
that
so you found out about their preprint, essentially, and you hadn't written up your results yet, but you had observed them.
Right.
And you undoubtedly got busy fast then.
We got busy very fast. Level was on our tails, and... Yeah, exactly.
But would you agree with me that it seems in my reading of the papers that the NRL one was virtually accidental, and also they did not understand really the nature of absorption in that very first paper. In fact, one can read it as indicating that they thought that the source was blocking the hydrogen behind
exactly.
it.
Exactly, yes. Yes. That's,
and then they quickly got straightened out, of course, and then there's what can be considered a classic paper by... Hagen, Lilly, and McLean explaining the absorption in great detail and so forth that came along later.
That's right. That's exactly the way I remember it, yes. Right.
What happened to Jodrell now? It doesn't seem to me there was much follow-up work on your absorption, or was there?
Not really.
Was this your thesis then, the equipment and the final success?
Yes. I think I guess I spent one more year at Jodrell. And felt that all things considered, I probably would not proceed with any further work in that area. And essentially turned it over to Rod Davies, who had by that time got considerable interest in galactic studies, galactic structure, and so on, and was anxious to carry on with the equipment to study various selected areas of the galaxy, and eventually wrote his thesis.
Right.
In that area.
Using that same dish.
Using the same dish, same equipment, yes. Right.
So what did you do then?
I left radio astronomy altogether in 1955 and went to work for Marconi Company in Canada.
I see.
Complete break. I must admit, I was a bit disillusioned by Jodrell Bank and its activities at that time. I wasn't in very great sympathy with the way Level Up was operating,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't get on terribly well. It was no secret. So my best policy was to get out now, sort of thing.
So then when did you come back into radio astronomy?
3 years later. I followed radio astronomy a little bit in literature in that period. And in 1959, I had one request to go to Harvard, probably in 1958, when Tom Gold was there, first went there, and he was looking for people to get going on 21 centimeters.
Right.
And that was just prior to the building of the Maser at Harvard. I did not go that time. Then I had this surprise request from Harold Weaver to come to Berkeley, which I did accept, I guess, in early 1959. Yeah.
And what was the situation when you got here at Berkeley?
Berkeley had just been funded at that time.
By ONR?
ONR. Right. To get going, and that was the mandate. Harold Weaver was the man who started that and was very anxious to get to do galactic studies in the 21 centimeter line. That was his.
Right from the beginning.
Right from the beginning. He'd followed the Dutch work or Van der Holst. He felt that was, you know, the way to study the galaxy.
Right.
And he wanted to get a group together to do specifically that.
But he started off as an optical astronomer, did he not?
Yes. Oh, yes.
How did this changeover occur? I'm hoping to talk to him later this week, but I'd be interested in what you think about it.
I've never really asked him that. I just, you know, it was just that there was this tool that enabled you suddenly to see across the galaxy, whereas...
So this, you think this may have been a case a bit like Oort, where he was interested in galactic structure, and he just saw this as another way to do it, rather than looking at star clusters and so forth.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, the star clusters were the thing that
he had. Because he had been working on galactic structure, really. Yeah, only in the neighborhood of the sun.
Right. Yes.
This was just, like you say, much more extensive.
Yes, I think that I'm sure that was motivation, but you want to check with.
Yeah, I will.
Yeah.
So, what did you work on for the first couple of years of Berkeley?
We're building Hat Creek, essentially. It took us far longer to get going here than was ever anticipated. There were material difficulties which had to be overcome. Getting a group together, people to work together, an antenna that would work.
This was now over the period 1960 until when did it finally get on the air?
Hmm.
Or at least 59, actually, until...
Yes. The first... I don't know the exact dates of that. the policy was to get the old 30-foot telescope here, 30-foot dish, built by Philco, to get that going as a pilot instrument with which the group would then learn how to do radio astronomy. Then to progress to the 85-foot telescope, which was coming along somewhat later.
Mm-hmm.
Decision was made, essentially before I came, to buy radio receivers from UN Knight, UN Day as it was, finally, the company that produced it. And quite early on, a scanning type spectral line receiver was purchased, and an X-band traveling wave tube receiver a la Frank Drake, both purchased from UN Knight.
Where did the dish come from?
The mirror was a Philco product, 33 feet.
That was bought from them?
It was bought from them, made specially for us, the largest size that we could get for X dollars at that time. The mount for it was built here, essentially, on site. And all the drives and so on were built by the group that was then growing in Berkeley.
So, when did you roughly get started? 64 or something like that?
It must have been.
I can ask Weaver for that more.
There's a written... if I'd known, there is a written history of dates, of key dates like this.
Oh.
That does exist.
Oh, yeah, well, definitely.
Harold will have it, or...
I'll ask him for it, yeah.
Right.
Good.
He's kept the history quite well.
Good.
He's done it through the proposals year by year, you know, and then he's had to cull it for various other campus committees at various times. He knows it quite well, much better than I do.
Well, what were the chief impediments? It made it take 5 years to... And now in 64, that was getting the 30-foot dish operating.
Yes. I guess it was. Yeah. It was working, but not producing, I suppose, is part of the answer. I did an early continuum survey with it, with old analog strip chart records that was never published. The first real work that was done with it was by a graduate student, Kimball Hansen, who made a study on integrated hydrogen of the Gould's Belt area of the galaxy. That was the first real work in the telescope. And then, of course, the big thing that got us going was the announcement of the OH line.
Right.
At just about that time, we found that we could quickly convert to the OH lines with the UNOID scanning receiver.
Are you speaking about the announcement of the emission or the absorption?
Absorption.
The absorption.
Yes.
So you switched over as fast as you could hearing about that.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happened?
We were able to detect crudely the absorption in the galactic center. I think we didn't make much of a contribution. The only contribution we made in the first paper that I can remember is that we did discover the 3 kiloparsec arm in absorption in the galactic center. That was
53 or something like that.
Yes. Right.
And then. Okay, so you continue to study the absorption. Continue the story.
Well, okay. During this period, the 85 telescope was coming along. I had been building, during this period, a spectral line receiver for it.
I see.
Which was also a scanning type receiver.
By scanning, you mean only with one filter?
Yes.
Which scans in frequency?
Yes. Right. There were actually two. We were using this double IF scheme. So that you are able to subtract off. You have one IF space from another exactly the amount that you are switching in frequency, so that the hydrogen ion either comes through one of the IFs, or when you switch frequency through the other one, so you pick up the square root of two, and it also happens that the you're switching the other side of the line, so that the base lines tend to cancel. And we used this technique at Jodrell Bank, and I was able to apply it to that receiver that we built here. We felt that was a big innovation here
right.
Of course, now appears a very small contribution. We'd been building, of course, the receiver for the 21 centimeter line, then there was a switch to the OH with that by add-on oscillators or whatever to get the thing up to work on the line. We then were able to detect the full smear of OH lines in absorption, the strange velocity components in the galactic center and so on. How do you want to handle it now?
The next stage is the emission. I think it's coming along here, isn't it?
Okay, yeah, I guess it is. I'm not clear on the dates, however.
Well, just tell me whatever you can.
Okay. I think as far as emission is concerned, a great credit goes here to Harold Weaver for his approach to the OH work that was being done at that time. He was systematically going around the galaxy, looking at all the Western Hare radio sources that seemed reasonable to look at. For, of course, the absorption features, looking for the velocity structure in them.
Right.
And we were, I guess, in in the nature of the Ave Survey of OH Absorption, when one night one of the operators called Harold Weaver from Hat Creek here and said that he had got some channels that are high and he couldn't understand it, and could it be a mission?
Right.
And Harold Weaver says, no, of course, it can't be, you know. well, wait a minute, you know, maybe it is. And that was essentially the discovery of the W49,
mm-hmm.
the emission source, with, I guess, the 10 kilohertz filters.
This was entirely independent from the work going on at Harvard.
Yes, yes.
Which was, I think, almost about simultaneous.
It must have been almost simultaneous. Again, it's an extraordinary thing. I was not here in Berkeley at the time. In fact, I was in Charlottesville. I forgot when I was on the 300 foot telescope or something, doing something else. And Harold called me and told me about that they thought they had discovered a mission, and I was to tell nobody. so of course I, you know, came back, you know, what is this, you know?
Yeah.
And now of course things get rather fuzzy because there's a lot happening in a short time. But the one thing that strikes me was that, you know, we went on around the sources and eventually hit on the W3 source. And you say, oh, that's strange. There's one spike you see in 10 kilohertz filters. It's about all it shows in you know, looks like a bad channel.
Right.
So could it be? Could it, you know? So I guess we changed the narrower filters, and indeed it was. And then we said, well, heaven's sake, we looked at this source last November. Why didn't we see it then?
Yeah.
This was, I guess, in the March or April of the following year. And, you know, so we'd been round once, and here we hit it. We turned up the old records, and sure enough, there it was. One channel way high.
Which you hadn't believed.
You see, everybody just gone over it. It was bad. It was interference, you see. It was on the records, you know, quite a while before that.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hadn't heard it.
But those things, you know, never, you know, it's only
it's an
anecdote, you know. It doesn't appear in the papers or anything.
Right. So, how did the development go? Was it pretty much as one would get it from the APJ supplement paper that... you then began taking high resolution and frequency profiles of five or six main sources, and what about the time variations? What could you say about that? I think that was something that was first picked up here quite definitely.
Yes, Nan was the one who was really involved very greatly in that. You know, I've been heavily involved in the equipment. Anything varies, I don't believe it, you know. I know it's the equipment,
right.
You know. But the point here was that, you know, Nan was saying, look, it's varying, you know, here compare this, you know, W3 is not varying, this other source is varying.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were forced into the fact that it looked as though indeed it was.
But you had some trouble convincing the rest of the astronomical community.
People were very skeptical about it, yes. Oh, absolutely.
Well, I think that brings it up to about the point where I'm going to cut off my history, because things just sort of get out of hand after the mid-60s. Unless you have some other things that you can think of saying, anything about the philosophy or the way the field is developed or anything like that, you're welcome to.
Not really. I think probably better not for me to philosophize. But the emphasis in my training and subsequent work has been in the instrumental side of things, predominantly, really.
Right. And in the spectral receivers, spectrometers.
Yes, right.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
That concludes the interview with Dave Williams on 4th June 1973 at Hat Creek.